From the studios of listener-supported WCQS, Western North Carolina Public Radio in Asheville, this is the 2016 Election Special. I'm WCQS News Director Matt Bush. Thanks for joining us. I think we can safely say this has been an election year and an election cycle like no other before it. And that is particularly true here in North Carolina, which has become one of, if not the bellwether state in this election. So move over, Ohio. Even with the hundreds of millions of dollars spent on ads and mailers and campaign rallies, there are still plenty of Western North Carolina voters who say candidates aren't talking issues most important to them. We'll hear from some of them later this half hour, as well as from campaign workers and volunteers who have been burning the midnight oil the past few months trying to get their candidates elected. We'll also try to gauge what the legacy of Clinton versus Trump might be with some high schoolers who'll be voting for president for the very first time. But we'll start with North Carolina's surging electoral significance on the national stage. Chris Cooper, professor and political analyst at Western Carolina University, stopped by our studios to answer why it's our state that has become so important and popular with presidential candidates and the national media.
I think it's been sort of a slow progression. So really in 2008 and 2012, people made a lot of the flip, right? So in 2008, we went blue. In 2012, we went red. And I think the whole country looked at us and said, well, something must be happening in North Carolina. I think the reality is we were actually just getting closer. So in 2008, of all the states that Obama won, his margin was the smallest in North Carolina. In 2012, of all the states that Romney won, his margin was the smallest in North Carolina. So we've actually been getting closer and closer to the kind of average state as time has gone on. So I don't think it's been this election cycle, although we've certainly gotten the news coverage for it this election cycle.
What are the factors that made everything get closer in the last 8 years?
You know, I think it's been a lot of things over the last 8 years. One is obviously in-migrants to the state, right? So we know that one of the main, if not the reason that North Carolina went blue in 2008 was in-migrants to the state who tended to register unaffiliated, which for the data geeks is very, very confusing to us. But they've turned out for Obama in pretty huge numbers. And so if you look at places like Research Triangle Park, Buncombe County certainly to some degree, Mecklenburg County, the places with lots of in-migration, I think that is what has made us more into a battleground state. At the same time, the whole South has been flipping, right? So the South went from overwhelmingly Democratic to overwhelmingly Republican over time. And I think North Carolina has been kind of a bellwether. We've never gone quite as – we weren't quite as Democratic as some of the other southern states, and we haven't become quite as Republican as some of the other southern states. So we sort of held closer to that line.
Where does Western North Carolina fit into that and how things have changed to make it so close? What effect has this area of the state had on that?
You know, this area of the state's really interesting for a couple of reasons. One, obviously, Buncombe County is very, very different than the rest of Western North Carolina. So I drove here today from Jackson through Haywood into Buncombe, and these are really three different political universes, certainly two different ones, Buncombe versus the rest of the region. So candidates who want to come here need to appeal to Buncombe County, which is reliably blue. They also need to appeal to places like Watauga and Jackson counties, which are sometimes red and sometimes blue, and then the rest of Western North Carolina, which is overwhelmingly red. So you've got this sort of strange dynamic within 23 counties that I think makes it hard for candidates to really understand. At the same time, this partisan shift that I talked about has been a little slower to happen in Western North Carolina. So to take Jackson County, for example, Jackson County is still overwhelmingly Democratic, but may vote red. And so I think that is sort of a sign of how interesting Western North Carolina is.
Why has the partisan shift taken longer to get here?
There's a lot of reasons for it. And I think one is race. So outside of Buncombe County, there's just not as large of a minority population. And so one reason we know that the partisan shift happened was that when African-Americans started registering to vote in much larger numbers, they went to the Democratic Party. And so as a result, a lot of white Southerners left the Democratic Party and went to the Republican Party. in an area like Western North Carolina with, you know, single digit proportions of African Americans, it's just a lot less likely that's going to happen. And so folks have held on to this sort of old mountain Democrat, blue dog Democrat idea, the kind of thing that Heath Shuler represented, I think, very well when he was in Congress.
Everything, or just about everything, is on the ballot this year in North Carolina. It's not just president, senate, you have governor and the General Assembly. You also have all these county level seats that are up. What effect does that have, having everything on the ballot all at once, all in one year?
One thing I think it does is to drive up voter turnout, right? If you are motivated at the local level, the state level, or the federal level, there's something on this ballot for you. And so the parties need to just really concentrate on getting people to the polls. For the individual candidates, the hard part is breaking through the noise, right? So if you are running for soil and water commissioner, for example, it's hard to get known. It's hard to let people know what you stand for. So I would expect we're going to see higher turnout, but also higher what we call ballot roll-off, where people vote at the top of the ticket, and then when they get lower down, they say, I've kind of lost track of who these folks are. I'm not going to cast an ill-informed vote.
And what effect does that have on races, such like maybe the county commissioners here in Buncombe County?
It could have a large effect on these kind of races. Obviously, the fewer voters there are, the more each vote matters. And so if you're running for county commission in Buncombe County or Haywood County or Madison County or anywhere else, the key is to get people to the polls and to let them know who you are. And so they have that name recognition when they come in. You've got a lot of out-of-state money coming in, which I think is a little bit unusual for things like state legislative seats and, you know, state senate seats and even some county commission seats. It's just more expensive to do everything right now. It's more expensive to run for office. You've got more state-level coordination with some of these races. So you've got state legislative seats where parties in Raleigh are sending in professional campaign managers to run those campaigns. It's a very, very professional environment from the bottom of the ticket to the top of the ticket.
But also having all these races on the ballot means a lot are getting overlooked, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. There's only so much media space that that can be filled. And right now it's been filled mostly with Donald Trump, and we get bored with that, a little more Donald Trump. Maybe a governor's race fits in. Maybe lately I think a U.S. Senate race has fit in. And if we know that voters learn about candidates for good or bad through media consumption, then it's been harder and harder and harder for folks to have the attention and the time and the information, frankly, to cast an informed vote lower down the ticket.
Chris Cooper, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Well, as Chris Cooper said, the increased significance of North Carolina in this election has led to increases in many other things, and that includes campaign workers and volunteers. And if you think it's tiring being a voter and getting through this election, just imagine what it's like for staffers. WCQS's Jeremy Loeb has this look on the unglamorous side of election year politics.
I wanted to find out what the election season was like for the actual people working it. And with the campaigns in full swing, there's no shortage of places to find them. On a beautiful Sunday afternoon, a Democratic campaign office in downtown Asheville was buzzing with activity. Jim Cook, a Nashville volunteer, had just gotten back from canvassing. He'd spent about 3 hours in the hot sun, but he definitely wasn't grouchy about it.
I had a map, and I used that in my everything to find the locations was the main thing, but it was so nice visiting with the people. I mean, I had people that came out and we sat in a swing and talked about, you know, different things that concerned them, and it was really nice.
Door-to-door is one method that campaigns use to reach out to voters. In a side room of the field office, another group of volunteers was hard at work.
Hi, is this Janice? Hi, this is Sean Robbins. I'm a volunteer with Democratic Campaign here in Buncombe County, and I'm wondering if you've had a chance to vote yet?
Sean Robbins had his cell phone out and a packet about 15 pages long with voter details.
I have a list of registered voters in North Carolina that I'm calling and reminding them that early voting is happening right now, and seeing if they need any help finding out where to vote earlier, if they need a ride to the polls or anything like that.
It can be grueling work. Robin says about 90% of the calls go like this.
Your call has been forwarded to an automated voice messaging system.
No answer. It's not tough, but I don't really enjoy it. I'm not really a gregarious phone person, and I don't like calling people, cold calling. But I've been here for a couple of hours, went through a big long list, didn't get a lot of people, but I feel like I'm doing something good.
Nearby, Lelia Adams, another volunteer, was hunched over a laptop. She was entering the data gathered by volunteers like Robinson Cook.
It's easy. And each time I come, it's maybe from 2 to 3 hours until I start seeing cross-eyed.
If all that work goes according to plan, those volunteers will be pushing lots of voters on to see Joe Sheridan and Donner Lonis. They're poll workers at Pack Library in downtown Asheville. Lonis says since early voting started October 20th, they've been filling one of two shifts to make sure things go smoothly.
One is 10 until 2, and the other is 2 until 6. But at 6 o'clock, we then have to pull out all of the ballots and put them in order by precinct. And that takes about 45 minutes.
When I visited on that same Sunday, things were slow but steady, giving Lonis and Joe Sheridan a chance to step away from directing voters to their voting booths and making sure they have what they need.
Have you been working most of the days that this has been going on?
Yes, I've been working since I started on the 20th.
Every day?
Every day except last Sunday, which was closed.
Does it get exhausting?
It gets exhausting when it's slow, because we get bored. When people are in there, no, it's not tiring. It's not exhausting. Mm-hmm. You know, I enjoy my work. I enjoy what I'm doing here.
And that's a sentiment shared by Lonis.
This is what America is about. We want people to come out and vote, not to just sit around and post things on Facebook. So, yeah, this is definitely very satisfactory.
But the work isn't done yet. And the busiest day of them all, Election Day, is still to come. For WCQS News, I'm Jeremy Loeb.
Temperament, emails, trustworthiness, Russia, those issues and others like it have dominated the presidential campaign. While in the North Carolina governor's race, we've heard a lot about HB2, teacher pay, and the state crime lab. But are those the issues that really matter to voters? Or are they just catchy headlines better served to spark water cooler talk at the office? WCQS's Davin Eldridge went around Western North Carolina to ask some voters what issues they wish candidates were talking more about.
After speaking with voters in Swain, Jackson, and Macon counties, the two issues which nearly all of them seem to share are jobs and education, regardless of whether or not they were decided or what their party affiliation was. The one thing that all of the voters had in common was that they felt there are issues the candidates are not addressing. One such voter is retired ecologist John Gladden, a Democrat in Macon County. Most of the things Gladden feels this year's candidates are ignoring are issues that hinder the efficiency of local government, issues like having better internet connectivity in the mountains, providing adequate educational funding, and improving PILT, that's P-I-L-T, or the Payment in Lieu of Taxes program. PILT was established in 1976 to provide rural counties containing sizable federal lands cash payments to offset the loss of tax revenues normally collected off of real estate.
If I were a county commissioner, it would really scare me because it's an annual appropriation. It has to be redone every year, and the numbers go up and down.
PILT funding is often used to fund basic public services, and Gladden says that county governments throughout the mountains struggle every year with their budgets because PILT dollars are erratically appropriated.
In 2015, all of the North Carolina counties got $3.9 million, and the year earlier, they got $4.2 million. You've got the budget you've got to work, the county operations, which is schools, police, medical care, so all the stuff that the county has to fund, and they've got this suspense hold sitting there. So if that money doesn't come through, then they either got to scramble to cut something or what they were hoping to get is actually funded.
While this is a problem Gladden says local leadership has done a decent job of trying to solve, he points out that they get no help from officials at the state or federal levels, something sorely needed to expedite Pilt's appropriations.
I've only heard one politician mention that this fall.
Instead of local politics, 21-year-old Swain County native Nico Chastain, a self-described New Age Republican, is concerned about the unique statewide issue of raising the age of juvenile majority to 18. And says he would like to hear gubernatorial candidates Roy Cooper or Pat McCrory take a position on the matter.
Juvenile jurisdiction should be raised from 16 to 18. Every other state has done this except for New York. You're ruining a child's life. Once you're 16 and you're charged as an adult, that goes on your permanent record forever.
Chastain says that he would back whichever candidate advocated for raising the juvenile age to 18, citing not only how outdated the current law is, but also the economic implications it has on the state.
You can't get jobs or anything. The smallest mistake you make, whether it's shoplifting or whatever, you're being tried as an adult. It's unnecessary. It takes a huge toll on the taxpayers, having to lock up so many people in there.
Aside from the governor's race, Chastain says that, as a Donald Trump supporter, he would like to hear his candidate talk more about how he plans on accomplishing all the things he plans to do as president, like building the Mexican border wall.
I want to see him in office, but I don't think right now that's what's going to happen, because he's not showing us anything. I want to make sure that he's not just talking and no action.
However, unlike Chastain, for Cashers Charter School teacher Amy Broyhill, it's not so much about what Donald Trump isn't saying in this election as it is about how her candidate, Hillary Clinton, is responding to Trump.
I genuinely believe that this is the plight that hits my children the most when I talk about rape culture, because I feel like I'm teaching my boys, while it's inappropriate for them to do these things to females, the highest seat in power is telling them it's okay. When they watch Hillary Clinton shrug these things off, they too are supposed to shrug these things off. I think she's spending too much time being a career politician, and I think that if misogyny and rape culture is not at the heart of a woman's policy on the year she's running for president, then she's missing the mark.
26-year-old Randall Jano, a credit analyst from Clyde who describes himself as an unregistered 1950s-era Republican, wants to hear more from the candidates about their positions on the Federal Reserve, an issue he says has spent far too little time in the spotlight during this election.
The one thing that appeals to me from having a financial background is government involvement in the Federal Reserve in monetary policy. People tend to lean against gas prices, health insurance costs, and while those really do make a difference in your day-to-day income and what you can buy and how much money is left over, the more macroeconomic scale of what the Federal Reserve does in their policy makes a very vast difference in their quality of life, short and long term. And I think it's not addressed deeply enough as it should be.
Jano says while federal monetary policy isn't as exciting as social issues, it's just as important.
You know, there's always going to be the similar topics that people get hung up on and single-issue voters get hung up on. But that's something that I think people are avoiding. To me, you know, I think the highlights of the election are typically social issues and then probably segue into tax. And then the next thing should be monetary policy.
Two counties over, 23-year-old Jason Tindall is like many other millennials in Western North Carolina, an undecided independent voter who's really only concerned about economic issues at this point, and echoes Jano's concern that all other issues should be secondary.
I would like to hear them talk more about issues like minimum wage, employment, basically just economics in general.
Tindall is a resident of Macon County, where jobs are scarce, and is recently unemployed. And now that the tourist season is over, they're even harder to find. So during an election year, he's really eager to hear from either side what their economic plan actually is, and is currently leaning towards Clinton. Finally, it should be noted that no matter what side of the issues these voters are on, the one thing they've all expressed is they're ready for this election season to finally be over. For WCQS News, I'm Davin Eldridge.
For the first time in two decades, voters in the city of Asheville will decide whether or not to let the city borrow money via bonds to fund a variety of projects. All told, the three bonds would total roughly $74 million and pay for a lot of road repaving and sidewalk construction and repair. But that's not all. I recently checked out one of the other projects on the city's list. It's tough to say the Swannanoa River Greenway is green in autumn, thanks to the fallen leaves that blanket the ground. In a watery basin just off the Greenway, litter piles up, in particular, beer cans. The city would like to spend $3.6 million to spruce up this walking biking pathway and park that separates the Swannanoa from Walmart and the Riverbend Marketplace. It's the most expensive project under the $32 million transportation bond voters will be deciding. There's also a $17 million Parks and Recreation bond, roughly half of which would fund renovations to the Grant Recreation Center and Memorial Stadium. The other bond, worth $25 million, deals with affordable housing, or rather, the lack of it.
If people were making tons of money building affordable housing, we'd have an overabundance of affordable housing.
Kit Kramer is the president and CEO of the Asheville Area Chamber of Commerce. The group supports all three bonds, but the housing affordability one in particular. Kramer says this is an issue government must get involved in because the real estate market is reacting slowly to the problem of workers getting priced out of the city.
Well, if you're a private developer and you have a choice of making substantially more on building luxury homes, for example, as compared to building affordable housing, and you've got a limited resource of the land, it's just a math problem.
$15 million would go to repurposing land Asheville already owns for affordable housing along the South Charlotte Street corridor, while the rest would go into a trust fund for the city to use on future projects. Opponents of the bonds, led by a handful of former elected officials, say that's too vague a plan to trust so much money on. They also argue a property tax increase would be needed to help pay off the bonds, a possibility the city admits is true. There's also the history of Asheville borrowing money. Bonds used to pay for the construction of City Hall and other projects in the 1920s didn't get paid off until the 1970s, thanks to the Great Depression. That stifled growth in Asheville, but supporters say that history is just that, history, and that Asheville is now in a much better financial place to borrow money to address the problems of 2016. You can get a full list of all the projects the city is looking to fund at our website, wcqs.org. Finally, what if this was the first presidential election you ever voted in, or could even remember? Could have an effect on how you view politics for the rest of your life. What kind of legacy Clinton versus Trump will have is something WCQS's Helen Chickering discussed with some high schoolers voting for the first time, and middle school teachers trying to teach an unprecedented campaign.
And then, of course, we have Crooked Hillary. Crooked Hillary, fuck.
What do we call that when two people can disagree, but they can speak nicely with each other?
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
It's this word. Civil discourse.
Seventh grade social studies class at Hendersonville Middle School. It's mid-September, about a week before the first presidential debate.
What is civil discourse?
That's teacher Kelly Deese. She's kicking off a series of lessons on election 2016. Today, it's a discussion about civil discourse.
It's been a more challenging year to teach these topics compared to other presidential elections.
I would say it is. It's just a real delicate dance all the time to make sure that the kids are informed and not bringing up more than they probably need to know at their age.
Loud and clear, please.
For this lesson, Dee stepped back into history.
So should three people adopt a form of government that they believe needs amendment?
Students are reading a play about the constitutional debate.
It pains me to disagree so strongly with those who sign.
How would you say that these two disagreeing men are speaking to each other?
It's like a non-heated argument as if they're having this conversation in respect for one another.
It was so beautiful just to go to those original documents and see how they could discuss things civilly.
Lessons that would become more challenging as debate season got underway. We checked back in on the class in mid-October.
Have you been watching any of the debates?
Yes, I have watched a bunch with my family.
Seventh grader Caden Coggins.
I don't think it's very civil.
They just seem to insult each other a whole lot.
Classmate Peter Garrison.
Which I don't think is very good.
Crizia Melendez agrees.
There's pressure on them, so there's like sort of like you sort of want to put the other person down to build yourself up, but I don't think it's the right thing to do.
Donald Trump, as he says himself, he has no filter.
Lily Deaver has some advice.
He could use sitting in this class and learning about this.
Overall, how do you think the debate went compared to the first two?
A few days later, we're a few miles down the road at North Hendersonville High School.
So Trump's temperament was a little toned down. Is that a good thing for him or is that a bad thing for him?
That's teacher Kyle Pope. He's hashing out the last debate with his civics and economics honors class.
Hillary, how did she do last time?
She smiled too much.
What's it like teaching election 2016?
It's complex in the sense that there are a lot of not just language, but even policy that can anger some people. We have a very large Hispanic population at this school, and obviously immigration has been a big issue. So it's kind of trying to balance those passions amongst the students with some of the more angry rhetoric that has been going around.
This moderator, better than the ones that we've had previously? He's really awkward, though.
My name is Ezra Morrison. I'm a senior this year. I think it'll be a crazy election night for sure. I think it'll probably be maybe one of the craziest ones in history. Doesn't help whenever we have one candidate saying that he may not accept if he loses the election, and one candidate that 70% of the nation says that they wouldn't trust.
I feel like this is more of a high school, like, popularity race than it is an actual, like, national election.
Senior Bailey Allen.
What would you like to hear?
I just want to hear, like, without feeling the need to completely, like, crap on the other candidate, just straight policy, like, here's how I feel.
Brian Moore is one of two seniors in the class who will be voting for the first time.
You made your decision yet? Do you want to share anything?
No, I haven't made my decision. I don't know. I've more leaned toward Clinton just because she's Democratic. But I don't know, Trump is still likely. I might vote for him, too.
I don't know. I just really don't feel comfortable about this election, really.
Fellow first-time voter Martin Padron is also on the fence.
It's really hard looking at the options that we have here.
Okay, so more centered.
What lessons are you preparing for post-election?
Just that they understand their responsibilities as citizens to stay informed, to not use one source but look at multiple sources for their information. Don't just look for sources that you agree with. See what the other side is saying and take it to heart.
Middle school teacher Kelly Dees.
I'm from one political party and my husband is from another, and I always tell kids, you know, I was married 21 years and we have children to show for it. You know, you can have civil discourse even in your home and disagree with things, but still want to get to the same place. We are going to take different roads to get to the same place.
Lessons these teachers wish they'd seen more of during the 2016 campaign. For WCQS News, I'm Helen Chickering.
And that's our election special from WCQS, Western North Carolina Public Radio in Asheville. You can hear more and see more on each story at our website, wcqs.org. This is just the first of many long-form programs coming from WCQS News, so tell us what you thought of it. Email us feedback@wcqs.org. And make sure you like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @WCQS. The WCQS News Team is Jeremy Loeb, Helen Chickering, Davin Eldridge, and myself, News Director Matt Bush. This program was brought to you with support from listeners like you. If you'd like to become a member of WCQS or continue your support, you can do so at WCQS.org. Thank you.